This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
And you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Radioactive Magazine. I'm your host, Pat Reilly. This evening, I have Jessica Padola with me. Jessica is the Director of Governmental Affairs for IUPAT, which is the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. Jessica, how you doing?
I'm great, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to hear your voice again. It's been a while since we chatted. May 1st, a couple of Saturdays ago, we had a PRO-ACT rally down at Ilis W. Davis Park in downtown Kansas City. Tell us about it. What went on?
This started as a rank-and-file event. I had one of my members, a third-year apprentice, A.J. Herrera, and a friend of his, Andy Mack from Smart Local 2, a second-year apprentice. Andy just called, or AJ called us up and said that he would like to do a May Day rally in front of the, and target Josh Hawley and talk about the PRO Act. And we thought it was a great idea. And, we reached out to local labor organizations, worked with the Missouri AFL-CIO on a petition to Senators Hawley and Blunt. And it was perfect because it coincided with a week of action by the National AFL-CIO, and around the PRO Act. There were May Day rallies around the country, and we participated in an action that could really change the game for working people in this country, not just labor people, not just union people, but regular workers. And it was good to see all of my friends. It feels very much like we are climbing out of the darkness. It had been a long time since I had seen some of those brothers and sisters in person. So it was a great event. We had the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists there as a co-sponsor, Coalition of Labor Union Women, of which I'm the president. We were out in force. We had IBEW Local 124. There were folks from Plumbers Local 8. I think we had some folks from Local 101, UAW 249, UAW 31, 710. I mean, CWA, SEIU, FGE, AFGE, rather, the Fight for 15 folks. Duke was there from the Kansas City AFL-CIO. I mean, we just, we had a really good group of workers. And, we talked about why the PRO Act is so important. We talked about how the deck is stacked against working people in this country. It was a beautiful day for a rally, and then we headed over to Topeka, and we rallied over there for their May Day rally at the state capitol as well.
Fantastic. Well, in case everybody, some folks out here aren't familiar with the PRO Act is the Protecting the Right to Organize Act that is was passed by the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. back on March 9th, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct, yeah.
It is, what did I have here? House Resolution 842, if I'm not mistaken. Let's talk about that PRO Act. It's gotten a lot of support from our president, which is a nice push. It's nice to have a pro-labor president again, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic. President Obama, as pro-labor as he was, it sure is nice to have a president who not only is not afraid to say the word union, but embraces union ideals and understands that when unions are at the table, workers are at the table, and that creates a better economy for everyone, not just the top 1%. It's just been really refreshing. But, the IUPAT worked really hard to get President Biden elected because he made a strong commitment to the PRO Act. And labor legislation has not been changed since the 1940s. And it's you know, it is time that we modernize worker protections in this country. We have some of the weakest laws for worker protections around the world, especially for a country that should be leading on these issues, right? So we are really, we're really excited. This is the best opportunity I think we'll have to get this accomplished. We are working diligently to, you know, get this across the finish line. And, you know, one nice thing about the PRO Act, Pat, is that this passed the House with bipartisan support.
Mm-hmm.
We had Republicans who are pro-labor Republicans that voted in favor of this legislation. We also had, I think, one Democrat voted against it. So Senator Hawley has laid out a case here lately in which he's really been targeting corporations. You know, he wants to hold corporations accountable. Well, this is a great opportunity for him to do that. He should get on board as Senate Bill 420 and support the PRO Act. You know, Senator Hawley likes to tell his constituents that he understands working class issues, that he wants every Missourian and every American to have an opportunity to, you know, pursue the American dream, then he should work diligently to create a an environment that allows workers to do that. So that's why we gathered downtown. That's why we gathered in front of his office. It's why we are circulating a petition with the AFL-CIO, because this is an opportunity. It's an opportunity for Josh Hawley to stand up for, you know, Missouri's working class and help us get this over the finish line. I don't think he'll do it. It's a priority for the president, and so far Josh has voted no on pretty much anything that the president's team or administration has put forward. But he should be given the opportunity to say so, and he should tell Missourians where he stands on this critical legislation.
Well, unfortunately, I think what we're seeing on the senatorial side in Washington, we still have the if it's you, then it's us, no. And that's, you know, this started back in the Obama administration when McConnell basically said, you know, our goal is to make it a one-term president and do whatever, everything we can to bollocks up the works. And they did a pretty good job of it.
Yep.
I think, like you said, right now, the way this passed with bipartisan support, that at least in the background, maybe not standing out on front in the on the table and pounding your shoe on the table and saying yes, but in the background, there's a lot of yes. And, you know, I think we all hope that they take a step forward for the workers. Like you said, we haven't really had any modification in the rules since the 1940s. You know, some of the things that the PRO Act addresses, it's really amazing. I'd like to touch on some of those topics too. You know, for instance, mm-hmm. let's just take a look at Bessemer. If anybody's familiar with Bessemer, that was the
right
vote a week and a half ago, I believe it was, in
Alabama.
That was one of the things that the PRO Act addresses, is allowing folks to not have to attend mandatory anti-union meetings while at work.
Yeah, we call those captive audience meetings, and they happen every day. They happen in retail settings, they happen at restaurants, they happen every day. This is a conversation where you have to go, and management is going to talk to you for however long they want to talk to you about how bad the union is. Maybe they're going to show you some movie made in 1984, you know, talking about how bad the union is. You know, they're going to have these conversations. They're going to talk about how, our culture is, if you have a problem, you can bring it to management. There's no problem that together as a team we can't fix. Lots of rallying the team type rhetoric. And then they'll say, and this is what happened in Alabama. They said, by the way, here's your election ballot. And for your convenience, we had the United States Postal Service put a mailbox right outside the facility here. So you can go ahead and you can fill out your ballot, and then you can go drop it in the mailbox. How do you think people are going to react when their boss keeps them in a closed-door meeting, anti-union rhetoric, and then says, oh, you can go ahead and vote now. And to make it easy for you, I put a box right outside the front door. I'm going to watch you now. Go place your ballot in the box. And we know that's the kind of activity that happened in the Amazon facility in Bessemer. Enough workers have spoken of that. I know that union has filed unfair labor practices with the National Labor Relations Board. And, you know, I mean, gosh, Pat, some of the stuff that I've read just makes your hair stand up. Every employee deserves the ability to go to work, work with dignity, work in a safe environment, have a break, use the bathroom, get a bite to eat, have a sip of water.
Be safe.
Right. You know, those are just basic human issues.
Yeah.
And, you know, these companies spend millions and millions of dollars in concerted, anti-union activities, and they are doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. Amazon is not spending the money they are spending on union busting because it's good for employees. And the PRO Act does address some of that stuff, right? Not only are those captive audience meetings outlawed, but also if a company is spending money on an anti-union campaign, they'll be required to disclose it. For a lot of campaigns, the first 90 days becomes like really critical, right? When a union goes and files for an election, generally speaking, you have about 90 days until that election actually happens. A lot can happen in those 90 days. It's estimated, I think I read someplace last week, that it's estimated that in more than 40% of all union organizing elections currently, employers are charged with breaking the law. Like 40% of current union elections, employers are charged with breaking the law. And if a union loses a vote, then they can't even talk to those employees for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so Donna Burks, my sister from CBTU, spoke Saturday about the plight of workers at Argosy and how they had tried to organize several years ago with the UAW. And they had a high number of signed cards, over 70%. So management clearly saw that the majority of that, that casino wanted a union. But between the time they filed for an election and the time the election was held, management spent a lot of money. There were a lot of captive audience meetings, a lot of anti-union rhetoric, and the UAW lost that vote. Well, then they can't talk to those employees again. Several years later, one of the Teamsters locals went in, and pretty much the same thing happened. But Donna said on Saturday that those employees were tenacious, that they knew that if they had a union in their workplace, that things would be better for them. So they stayed after it. And they eventually did win a union vote. And they're organized with the UAW. So the PRO Act is going to level the playing field for labor unions. But what we all need to remember is that when we have strong labor unions, there's a huge ripple effect to that, right?
No doubt.
I mean, it's not just about wages and benefits. It's also about worker safety. And I think if anything that we have learned in the last year, work-life balance is critical to a thriving community. And frankly, as we are starting to emerge out of this pandemic, it's going to be crucial as we watch women reenter the workforce. How are they reentering? It's estimated that 1.2 million women still have not returned back to work or may not return back to work.
And that was one of the biggest labor loss during the pandemic was women being employed.
Well, absolutely. And, I'm lucky. I'm I'm a union member, Pat. Mm-hmm. I was able to negotiate time that allowed me to virtually supervise my children as they were in virtual school. You know, my boss was very flexible with me in that regard, but a lot of workers didn't have that luxury. And a lot of these workers that we're talking about that have left the labor market are not necessarily union workers. Only 6.9% of Americans belong to a private sector union. And when you add in public sector, you're still in that 12 to 13% range, right? It's not a tremendous amount of Americans that have the luxury of a collective bargaining agreement that affords them some protection. That's why it was really easy for us to turn grocery store clerks and teachers into heroes at the beginning of the pandemic and for us to vilify them now. Of course, they're all heroes when we're trying to stock up and make sure we have enough toilet paper to last for the next 3 years or, you know, our freezers are full. But the minute we try to label those employees as essential employees and ensure that they're getting hazard pay, we've gone, you know, a step too far.
Sure.
Right? Mm-hmm. So I think about my daughters, my children's teachers, and the amount of time in the last year that my kids have spent in quarantine because of exposure or whatever the case may be, and the lack of protection that the teachers have had, the lack of community support that they've had, and we wonder why we're having labor shortages right now, right? Like, right. Who wants to go back to work at a grocery store for $10 or $12 an hour in an environment in which you are ridiculed, you're exposing yourself to a deadly virus, and your employer is ungrateful for everything that you're doing and you're not making a living wage.
And makes no effort to try and make it more secure for you.
Right. And, you know, and those are the reasons why we need the PRO Act. You know, we need the PRO Act to ensure good jobs for everyone. Historically, unions have turned bad jobs into good jobs. And, you know, one industry after another, all workers need and deserve the collective power of a union to help achieve decent pay, secure benefits, flexible schedules, fair treatment and basic respect. You know, I have friends that are in the service industry, and they've really hurt over the last year. And now they're returning to work, and they're finding fair scheduling issues. I have a dear friend that works part-time at a bar, and she is expected to work a double on Friday, so she's closing Friday night, and then she's got to be in there and open on Saturday morning. And she doesn't want to complain about it. She needs the money to feed her family. Unions are also about ensuring that workspaces work for everyone. And, you know, most unions have really good relationships with the employers that are signatory to them because we want our employers, we don't want them to go out of business. We want them to be profitable. We want to work with them to figure out the best way for them to be profitable while also caring for and treating their workers with respect and dignity.
And one of the misidentifications that I have found when talking to folks about union and organizing, you know, I have heard in the past, well, it protects bad employees. No, it doesn't. Because I can tell you right now, and you know as well as I do, Teamsters and right down the line, it doesn't make any difference what union it is. If you have a bad employee that's either, you know, not doing the job, not doing what's supposed to, the unions don't want those folks messing up the relationship and the work that they have put in to organize and work with management and the companies. And that the thing of the past of protecting bad employees, it's not an accurate picture.
Right. I think, you know, in some ways, labor contributed to its own downfall historically, right? You can think about some of the stereotypes of who
union
labor
thugs.
Leaders were, in the 60s and 70s and that kind of stuff. And look, there was some truth to that, absolutely for sure. Did labor leadership historically make room for women, for minorities, you know, for community partnerships, all of those things? The answer is not everywhere, right?
Right.
And probably not. That's why you had coalition group or constituency groups like the Coalition of Labor Union Women or the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. I mean, those groups were founded out of a need and an action. But the modern labor movement is diverse, and it is forward-thinking, and it is introspective, and intersectional, and intentional, and working deliberately with union members, non-union members, with community-aligned groups to create communities across this country that work for everybody, union and non-union. You know, that's why we can have community benefit agreements to make sure that if an airport is going to be built, there's going to be a strong pre-apprenticeship program to not only provide a pipeline of employees at the airport, but a pathway for these workers to have a career in the trades, which can be life-changing, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, labor sometimes, we're our own worst enemy about sharing all the, you know, the gospel of labor, the good news, the things that we're doing really, really well. And so people still have this perception that we're, you know, a bunch of fat cats sitting around a table smoking cigars and beating up employers or contractors or, ticket, you know, that, like that. We can't exist like that. We can't thrive like that. We have to change. We have to expand. And labor unions can still be the place where civil rights changes are occurring. But we have to be really intentional about that, right? You know, I think back to President Trump. He addressed the Missouri AFL-CIO after a few months after Mike Brown was shot in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how one of his union brothers shot and killed one of his union sister's children. And we still, you know, I say that to say, like, labor is aware of the really big, deep societal issues that we face. And every labor union has to have a reckoning within itself about what type of labor union they're going to be today and tomorrow. Every labor union should be working diligently to get the PRO Act across the finish line and to President Biden's desk. And then we should work really hard to make sure that people want to join unions, that they see that when they are protected by a collective bargaining agreement, that that means that they're going to be doing the same work for the same pay as their brothers if they're a woman, or that they can lift their entire family out of poverty, that being in the trades is not only a sound job, but it's a really good career and one in which you will work however much you want to work, wherever you want to work, if you're trained and skilled. Mm-hmm. But it's also about low-wage earners and fast food workers working with dignity and service workers working in an environment free of sexual harassment. It is about grocery store clerks being protected and making a living wage. You know, it's all of these things. And the PRO Act is our best opportunity to create structural change, to really start to address these issues as a movement.
I'd like to read something here real quick. Economic Policy Institute is one of the trades that I follow. Mm-hmm. They had a report in 2016 that said, and I quote, "Pay for private sector workers has barely budged over the past 30-plus years. For men who lack a college degree and do not belong to a union, real wages today are substantially lower than in the late 1970s. A 2019 BLS report, on average across the country, union workers make approximately $1,100 a week. Non-union members make approximately $890 a week. That's a 20% difference. And that doesn't include... That doesn't include your benefits, your perks, health, insurance, time off, paid time, paid leave, vacation. you factor all that in, and you know, really higher pay in organized establishments increases the competition for labor. You know, it makes non-union right. firms lift their wages so employees don't leave for higher pay union jobs.
Right. You know, I was having this discussion with a friend of mine, and we were talking about the Fight for 15, which has been a long campaign and an arduous one, and continues. The struggle continues for our allies at Stand Up KC and around the country. But think about where we are in relationship to where we were 3 years ago with the Fight for 15. You know, $15 is becoming the standard wage that retail employees are starting to offer. So, you know, sometimes these campaigns are also about applying long-term public pressure, right? Like right. the arc of the moral universe bends, but it doesn't bend fast, right? It's a long, deliberate process. You know, for the record, the state of Missouri, we raised the wage in 2018, and the Missouri legislature has spent a good portion of time this session trying to roll that minimum wage back. Increase back in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a fight that is ongoing. And sometimes we have to remind ourselves that the Fight for 15 is not the ceiling. It's the floor.
Right.
Well, and
if you take a look.
It's not even a living wage.
No.
Right? I mean,
it's $30,000 a year if you're working a full-time 2080. You know, if you do 40,
right.
multiply 40 by 52, it's 2080. 15, it's $30,000 yep. a year. It's not even a sustaining wage.
Right. And, you know, several years ago, I think it was ProPublica that released that long form report about poverty in America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're poor in this country, it takes 20 years of everything going perfect for you to climb your way out. That's no sick days. That's no unexpected flat tire. That's no hospital visits. I mean, everything has to go perfectly for you. And that is an impossible task. Life does not work that way. And so we pay people poverty wages. We shame them for getting societal benefits and in whatever shape that takes. And then we don't give them any kind of help to get out of that situation.
Mm-hmm.
When is the single mother of two, who is the average minimum wage worker, by the way, a 34-year-old single mother of two, who's working not one but two jobs, when is she supposed to go to school? When is she supposed to get the training that she needs or the education she needs to pull her family out of poverty? What is she supposed to do with her children when child care is expensive? And by the way, it's not like child care workers are making $15, $20 an hour. They're not, mm-hmm. right? Like the whole system is very, you know, I think we've seen this year, like we're just kind of teetering on three legs here, and we're really in trouble if one of those legs, you know, crashes underneath us. The whole system will fall down. And that's one thing the pandemic, I think, has shown folks around the country, around the world, very clearly. Together, we can create a country that works for everyone. But we have to be willing to want what's best for our neighbors as well as what's best for ourselves.
Exactly.
And that's kind of at the core of what labor unions are about, right? Like,
right.
We want what's best for workers. We're passionate about making sure the workers are getting the very best that they can possibly get.
To switch gears here, because we're starting to get a little low on time, we talked briefly a little bit earlier before we started the interview here about the right to work. And it seems like here we go again in the state of Missouri. Missouri Senator Eric Burleson has introduced Senate Bill 118, and you told me there's also a House bill that's been added, HB 690, to put right to work back on a ballot initiative possibly in November of 2022. How many times do we have to bang these guys over the head in Jefferson City before it sinks in that 67 or 68% of the citizens of the state of Missouri are not for right to work?
Yeah, Eric Burleson is definitely, you know, like a dog with a bone. I hate to say it, but I remember when he was in the House and he was instrumental in getting Right to Work passed in the House. You know, I think everyone in labor has expected just about every anti-worker bill he